I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today, I welcome to the show James Prescott. He's coming to us from England, and he is a writer, a blogger, and now a podcaster. Welcome to the show, James.
Hi, Lisa. Yes, thank you. I'm James Prescott. I'm a writer. I'm a blogger. I'm a podcaster and an author from near London. I won't tell you the name of the town because you won't know where it is, but it's just outside of London in the south of England. And yeah, and I love writing. I love creating stuff, and I write a lot about creativity and spirituality and identity, and I do a bit of coaching as well. So yeah.
And I don't know if you know this, but I actually lived in England for a time when I was in college.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I lived in High Wycombe, right between Oxford and London.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I went to the Polytechnic there for a trimester. And it was, here's my confession, because I think listeners might hear me start to emulate your accent. And that's what I do. I empathize with whoever I'm speaking to, and I wind up absorbing some of their, you know, traits in their accent. And I definitely did it when I was living in England, because I didn't want to continually sort of be stared at as the American all the time. Mm-hmm. And so, especially when I went into the bank to get like my traveler's checks cashed or whatever, obviously this was a pretty long time ago, I would say thank you, and that would try to like avoid being stared at with the American accent. So you might hear little twinges of slightly British, but you know, butchered accent. But after I spent some time in England, I went around Europe backpacking and doing the whole Euro Rail Pass thing. And,
oh, wow.
And it was really one of those things that I knew that if I didn't do it when I was there, it wasn't going to happen probably, because just coming from such poverty, and I basically made it, I think it was 28 or 30 days on only $500. So I actually went hungry a lot and slept in a lot of train stations. But I got to see Prague. I got to see Corfu in Greece, and Tuscany, and just all, you know, 11 countries. And it was a whirlwind, but it was just one of those things you can't, there isn't a price on it, you know? So have you ever been to the United States?
No, I haven't. This is my, this is something I talk about a lot with people. My sister keeps telling me I need to go to America, that God's got something for me in America, you know. Mm-hmm. And she kind of jokes with me that I'll end up marrying an American or something.
So, it could happen, yeah.
You could do. Yeah, I mean, I've got so many friends. Most of the people who read my work and listen to my stuff are actually American. Mm-hmm. I don't look at my stats that often, but last time I looked, over 50% of people who read my work are from America. So it would kind of make sense for me to go and live in America and do my stuff over there, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I love America. I've got so many friends over there, so many mostly writer, creative kind of people all over the place. I've got quite a few in Nashville and some on the West Coast as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, and I would love to go to New York. I mean, that's like, just love to go there. So,
yeah, well, you could make a little bit of a stateside tour and kind of, I'm sure that if you planned it out, you could stay with a lot of different friends and people you've connected with and do it if that's something that you could get away from work to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I've been thinking about this and I haven't made any plans whatsoever, but wanting to get into coaching professionally, that's something that if I could make a living out of that, then I don't have to be in one place to do that. Right. I can just take my laptop with me and do it. So in theory, if I could do that, then I'd be in a position where I could just travel around America and I could coach people for money pay my way around America, you know, and just visit people and go to different places. So that's kind of a medium to long-term ambition of mine. And it's something that I'm wanting to do. And coaching is something I really want to do because I love to help writers. And I've been coaching somebody and it's really, really gone well. And I've enjoyed it. And they've done really, really, really done well. So it's something I really want to do. Yeah.
Yeah, That would be great. Well, you can definitely stay. Now, I don't live in New York City. I think I might have mentioned I am on New York time, but I live in Pennsylvania, and pretty out of the way place. But you're definitely welcome to stay here for a while if you decide to come over. And I wanted to kind of, what I do with a lot of people who come on the show is I ask them about their spiritual and religious background and early formation. And so I'm curious to hear, I have read quite a bit on some of the things that you've said, but for listeners who aren't aware of who you are and where you're coming from, maybe you could just kind of talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I kind of began, I've never kind of had a point in my life where I've not been involved in church. My parents are Christians, and I was baptized as a baby and taken to Sunday school and all that kind of thing. So that's where I kind of began. I think there's a few key kind of moments in my life looking back now, which have been key moments in my spiritual formation, I would say. The first one was when I was 8 years old. My mum had an asthma attack. And she was in a coma for a long time. And when she finally came, they didn't think she was going to live. She did survive. But she suffered brain damage to her short-term memory, which is another whole story. But the first thing, she rang my dad when she came out of the coma. And the first thing she said to him was that she had been with Jesus by Galilee, and that he had sent her back.
Wow.
So, you know, I heard this at 8 years old, you know, and I was part of Sunday school then, but, you know, I don't know what I was thinking, if I'd taken it seriously or not, but that definitely kind of sparked my interest, I think, in kind of thinking about this a bit more deeply, I think. The next thing that happened was also to do with my mum, and that was 15 years later. Now, by this time, I'd kind of been going to church, I'd been involved with student Christian stuff, doing missions and kind of really kind of on the evangelical part of the church, and you know, a lot of kind of falling on the floor and Holy Spirit stuff, very evangelical Christian, traditional, and my mum died. She had an asthma attack, another one, and die. My parents had broken up by then, but they were friends. But they had broken up, so this was kind of, I only realized this now looking back, to be honest, that this kind of, it gave me questions. Suddenly the God that I had believed in wasn't big enough anymore. It was like, well, this, how did this happen? You know, God could have stopped this and he didn't. And yeah, how can everything be certain if this happened? This just doesn't make any sense, you know. And I wasn't aware that I was asking these questions at the time or that anyone else was asking these questions. You know, I was just kind of like, well, things don't make quite as much sense anymore. God is big different than I thought he was. This can't be it. You know, there has to be something else, you know, not in terms of is there a God, but there has to be, God has to be bigger than the God that I've kind of been following, you know. And I really didn't have any answers for a while. I just kind of pottered along, and I had these questions, and I didn't know where to go with them. And this was like 3 or 4 years this went on. And then this is like the next major event. I was at a Christian camp, which we have in the UK, called Soul Survivor, which is quite big. And I went to the bookstore, and I picked up this book called Velvet Elvis by Rob Bell. I went back to my tent and I started reading it, and I literally read it in 2 hours. I didn't literally put it down at all. I was just so compelled by this book, and it was kind of like, oh, I'm not alone in this. I'm not the only person who thinks like this, and it's allowed to ask questions, and it's allowed to doubt, and it's allowed to God can be bigger than what I've made him, and God isn't all about certainty, and yeah, that he's not just this far distant in like far away God. He's actually like with me in my circumstances, in all these things that I've been through, and all these questions that I've had, and it's no exaggeration to say that book changed my life completely. It was nothing was ever, it's one of those moments that, mm. you know, you can't go back after you've, you know, I mean, like, obviously, right. like losing a parent and that kind right. of thing. You can't go back
right.
when you've had these kind of moments. And I think we have to, I think the way that we change and the way that we grow is going through traumatic experiences. And these aren't always like bad things, like losing a parent. There mm-hmm. they can be things like reading a book or going to a conference and hearing somebody talk, and it kind of disrupts you and throws you out of where you were and you can't go back. But yet you can't quite comprehend it in your mind what it is has happened to you. Mm-hmm. And it takes you a while. So that's what was happening. And then I kind of saw his talk, Rob Bell's talk called Everything Spiritual, which was, I'd never really been interested in science, but suddenly I kind of suddenly saw that science was spiritual and that everything mm. was connected, and mm-hmm. hearing all this stuff about the science of the universe, which kind of blew my mind. And,
yeah.
and suddenly God got like absolutely massive, and it was like, wow, this is awesome. You know, I was kind of like getting excited about my faith again, you know, and this is around the time I started blogging about faith and stuff, because I was just beginning to discover my kind of gift and calling as a writer. Mm. And I was writing a lot about this at the time. And but then there was another major event, which was actually just this last April, which was a two-day event with Rob Bell. He's had a massive influence on me. But he expanded on the kind of scientific stuff that I'd already heard, and I took it even deeper and bigger, and also talked about what's called spiral dynamics, which is a kind of theory about human consciousness and different levels of human consciousness, which is I'm going to do a podcast episode of my own podcast about this, because it's just it's really just completely mind-blowing, and I still haven't quite come to terms with it, because I'm seeing it everywhere, but everywhere now, in everything. And you know, I've been reading lots of books about creativity, about vulnerability, about non-dual spirituality, by Richard Rohr.
Yeah.
And this is all kind of linking it all together, and suddenly God is getting really big, and suddenly my spirituality is evolving. And I actually found myself saying on Twitter the other day that I'm not an evangelical anymore. I'm not an evangelical Christian at all. I still consider myself to be a Christian, very much so. But God is so much bigger to me now, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has kind of impacted my perspective on LGBT issues, because this is an issue that I'm quite passionate about equality just generally, especially in the church. You know, I've been quite a strong advocate of empowering women and women in leadership and all that kind of thing, but also of the LGBT community in the church. I'm kind of an ally. I'm not gay myself, but I'm kind of an advocate for that community, and I think that's really, really important. And that's actually kind of led me into seeing the Bible differently, and it ties in with all of this other stuff that I've been thinking about. So everything, I'm seeing that everything is interconnected. Mm. So I'm kind of still on this journey, and this is kind of what led me to doing my podcast, and it's influencing everything that I'm doing now. So, and I'm literally just at the beginning, I feel, and it's really exciting, you know, because, you can probably tell that I'm just kind of, it's still, I haven't kind of come to terms with it all yet. And actually, I kind of hope I don't, because then I'll still be learning.
Right.
Or maybe I'll come to terms with it, but then I'll have something else that I'm still kind of dealing with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm kind of still growing.
Well, I think that as we interact with God, and, you know, and here's that word God, is that typically if I say God, pictures come to mind and people think in categories right away. But, you know, when we come to terms with God as the ultimate truth and the creator and the source, I think that intimacy means that God continues to invite us in deeper and deeper and explode all the boxes that we continue to put him in. And just when we think we've got it figured out, that box will explode and bring us into something sometimes at first very scary and unknown, and sometimes very comforting. And and I think that what you're experiencing is this sort of embrace of God and God in all things, in terms of being God is everywhere present and always accessible. And it ties you to other people in a new way, and it ties you to what God is up to in a whole new way. And so I can definitely relate to that. And our frameworks that we start with in as Christians through a Christian lens, it's not like that they have to be erased, because even if we don't, you know, like you're saying, you don't consider yourself an evangelical, but part of your formation, you know, sort of indistinguishable probably from you to a degree. And then it's the starting point for so much more. And so, I've had a pretty, well, in many ways, a similar experience to you as well. And also had some things that I think in traditional, at least in the United States, in evangelicalism and fundamentalism, the more mysterious sides of God or the mystical sides of Christianity are, people are completely unaware of them or very suspicious of them. But I have found in a lot of times, and that is changing, but I've found that reading the Christian mystics in Greek Orthodox tradition and in Catholic tradition and even some evangelical tradition now is really, you find a lot of commonalities across spiritual mysticism in all traditions. And you just can't get around that you're basically talking about the same thing using different language. And it gets into particulars more within Christianity, of course, with Jesus and things like that as a as a different type of lens. But now, and I think I've heard Rob Bell say this too, once you've seen something, you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's going on. Because I've felt very much like, well, I can't go back to what I was thinking. I cannot do it. It's impossible.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, this is just, it's like I was saying, yeah, any kind of traumatic experience, like any kind of, this is linked with spiral dynamics.
Maybe you can actually, not like you could possibly get well into it.
No.
But I mean, like in a general sense, what are we talking about?
Spiral dynamics, well, it's basically a theory about human consciousness. And I can't remember how many levels there. Well, there's two kind of levels of consciousness, but there's kind of different stages of consciousness within those levels. And it starts out with kind of, and they're all colours, and I can't remember what colour's which, but you start off with this kind of basic human needs, like I need food, I need shelter, I need kind of things. So there's kind of like that's where it all starts. And then it goes on to kind of, there's outside forces kind of controlling everything that goes on, like the rain and the weather and all this kind of thing. And it's kind of, so you get into kind of more mystics and shamans, and, you know, the shamans have the power and the kind of village elders have the power. And, you know, and so it's all kind of a bit more mystery and exploration of what's going on out there. And then you get to kind of like a power kind of thing, which is more about I can't remember. It's more about power, more kind of aggressive, kind of more controlling, where you've got more knowledge and there's kind of, it's more, power's more centered. And then you move on to this is the one that I kind of know the best, because it's the one I see in the evangelical church so much, and actually in government. And it's, I know the color of this one, it's blue. This is more about, it's more about structure and hierarchy and certainty and everything ordered. And then so you have that one, and then you move on to another one, which is about logic and reason and knowledge. And, you know, it's quite, a lot of that's to do with science. A lot of that's to do with, you know, but it's not just science. That you could put kind of academic theology in there, in a sense. But then you have that. And then you move on to stuff like social justice, causes, like causes which are just outside of kind of the basic structures that you have. So people are concerned, people start to see the benefits of more than one level of consciousness. And you have, I should have my notes really in front of me on this, because I made about 40 pages of notes. But And then, but then that's the end of kind of one part of one level of consciousness. And then you go to the next one, and it's not like that you are one, you belong to one of these groups.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you can, because when you get to the second tier consciousness, you actually start to see the benefits of every single other stage that you've gone through.
Mm.
So there's benefits to basic needs. There's benefits to structure. There's benefits to logic and reason. There's benefits to like social justice and all different kinds of causes, which are really, really important. And there's, you know, there's an importance to mysticism and mystery and the unknown, and, you know, but all of them have bad things as well. And some of them can be linked to other ones. Like, for example, the last stage of first tier consciousness can be linked very much with the power and the aggression and all that kind of thing. Because when you think about like people who support different causes and charities, whatever, they go on marches, they go on protests, and they can get quite aggressive in their tactics.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go around, and there's links between different different stages of consciousness. I've not done a really good job of explaining it.
Well, but, you could come back on another occasion and we could get into it more. But I know that people are probably just in general unfamiliar, with it. But you're saying that the second stage is something beyond. Is it in the unseen world then?
Well, the second tier is when you start to see the benefits of all the other tiers, and you're kind of including all of them. It's not about we're kind of progressive, so we've moved beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
It's more because what can happen is if you're at one stage of consciousness, say you're in the blue stage and you're very into certainty, and this is a really, you'll probably see the clear metaphor that I'm pointing to here, but it's not very subtle. But if you're into kind of structure and certainty and order and hierarchy and all that kind of thing, it's very difficult for you to, you can look down on anybody who's in any of the stages before you with disdain. Like, for example, really intelligent people can be very kind of intolerant of people who aren't as clever as them, for example. Some intelligent people, no names. And not me.
No, that would be crazy.
No, not me. But there's quite famous people who are quite clever who do that. I'm sure I don't tell you who. But for example, so you can look back at past stages with disdain, but you can also look forward in fear. So people in this blue section would look ahead to people who are maybe going into the areas of logic and science and social justice and different causes, and then going to the kind of almost to the stage where they're transcending every stage, and so they're including the kind of mystics and the and the mystery and the unknown and the unseen and the inclusivity of all things. They look forward to that. They look ahead to that with fear. Mm-hmm. So, and it's not quite, the metaphor is not very subtle, but you know, it's clearly like, because I would say the evangelical church is very blue. It's all about certainty and order and structure and everything like that. But anyone who wants to kind of move ahead of that and is looking back and including stuff like the mystics and mystery and unknown and seeing is being inclusive of all different kinds of ideas, is people are afraid of that because it's a different level of consciousness. And, you know, I mean, it kind of, when you go into more detail about it, and there's loads of stuff online about it, it kind of just kind of like, wow. And like, I came away from it was Rob Bell that talked about this. And after that talk, literally, I went to church that day and I looked at every relationship, every person, I looked at everything differently. And now I'm seeing everything differently. Like I'm seeing this play out in everything. And you can actually, the best creative work actually takes you through different levels. Like there's one album which I just got, by a band called Gunga. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're really amazing. They're into all this kind of stuff. And they're making like three albums which are kind of connected. And this first one, I think it's One Wildlife Soul, I think it's called. But if you listen to it as a whole album, it takes you through these and you're really attuned to it. You can see it taking you through these different levels of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them are important. It's just that the really important thing, the place that we need to get to is that where we can see the benefits of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this has really big implications for the church because I'm an advocate of inclusive church. And I think this is really, really important, because what often happens is that you have one group in the church, and then there's a more progressive group, and they go off and start their own church. Mm-hmm. This has happened through history. You know, mm-hmm. what is now seen as the evangelical kind of norm used to be like a really radical kind of almost heretical kind of concept, you know. Mm-hmm. Not that people would say that now, of course. Mm-hmm. but what happens is the progressives kind of break away and they form their own little group. But then eventually that group becomes the status quo.
Right.
And there's progressives in that group, yeah, who want to break away.
Right.
So what I would like to see, I know that it's a big dream, but is a church where you can say, well, where there's room for the more progressive people, but the people who want to stay where they are can be there, and they can coexist.
Mm.
You can have it, you can say, like, okay, we disagree, but we all love each other, and we meet together, and we break the bread together, and we drink wine, and, you know, we pray and all that kind of, and we listen to teaching, and we have community and fellowship, and we support each other, and we're accountable to each other, and we have community together. And, you know, okay, we have disagreements on certain aspects of how we see God and how we relate to God, but ultimately we're all together in one community, you know, and that's kind of an idealistic.
Yeah. So James, you really want the church to be full of grace or something like crazy like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Actually, it's funny because my first print book that I'm publishing next year is about grace.
Mm.
And I talk about this in that book. Yeah. I mean, I want church to be a place where you can go and just be who you are. That's like an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. You have to go and you have to own who you are. You have to say, I'm an alcoholic. You have to own it. Yeah, and it's okay. You can say that, and it's a safe place to be completely vulnerable, to be who you really are, and be accepted and welcomed and like loved as you are. You know, that's what church should be. It shouldn't be a place where secrets are hidden. It should be a place where where there aren't any secrets, where you can be open about who you are and be vulnerable and just know that you're accepted,
yeah,
and there's no judgment. You know, that's what church should be like, and it should be inclusive of everybody.
I think what we tend to do as people looking for patterns and looking for categories and looking for ways to help our situation make sense is that we are always confusing the container for the thing. And so, you know, I heard this parable or something where, you know, the spiritual teacher points to the moon and says, that's the moon. And then people think of the hand pointing as the moon, you know? So it's like, no matter what container you're going to put it in, progressive or fundamental, or it's still a container that is trying hard to hold this reality. But in truth, there is no container, you know? So it's like, so the grace has to be the common denominator. Love and grace have to be the common denominator, because that's the only real thing going on, you know? So I think that is, you know, one of these sort of ongoing problems that slowly, I think people are waking up to something else and something new. It's kind of exciting to see that. So in terms of what you've just written in about creativity and authenticity, I'd like to know what got you to write about the book and what are some of the main points you lay out?
Okay, well, this is going back to last year. I've been writing, I've been blogging by then for about 9 years, and I'd just recently done some writing courses, which were designed to help you be more professional and to get your blog looking more professional, and tips on how to make your work more accessible and all that kind of thing. And so I've been doing that, and I'd done a couple of ebooks which I've given away free on my blog, and I've opened up a subscriber list and all this kind of thing. I've got a design done and everything. And they didn't have, the ebooks that I gave away didn't have the impact that I hoped or expected. And I was getting a bit down about it. And I spoke to some close friends who I trust very, very much. And they told me straight out, you know, your writing hasn't been the same for the last few months. You don't sound like, it doesn't sound like you. It's not, you know, you're trying to play to the audience too much. You're trying to, too hard to get people. You're more interested in numbers than you are in. And I hadn't realized this had happened. I had no idea at all. But when they said it, it sounded right. You know, it was kind of something clicked. Like, yeah, this is what's happened. And I was so annoyed with myself, because authenticity and artistic integrity are things that are really important to me. And somehow along the way, I kind of lost them. And so I kind of decided, I thought, right, I'm going to stop publishing work publicly for as long as it takes. I'm just going to stop. So that's what I did. I stopped blogging publicly, and I decided that what I would do instead is I would write every day on a private blog, which nobody would know about and nobody would know where it is. And it would just be free writing. It wouldn't be planned, structured. It would just be whatever comes out, and I'd do it every day. And so I did that. And it was really a really transforming time. To start with, it was quite messy and didn't have much to say. But what eventually happened was I actually started to find my voice. I actually started to find out what I really cared about. And lots of ideas started to come to me. And literally, it became the most creative season of my life. It was kind of, and it was transforming in terms of my voice and my message and what I want to write about. And yeah, because what happened is that I discovered a passion for talking about authenticity, and I discovered a whole kind of set of ideas about how we can discover our identity and how we can maintain our artistic integrity and how we can write and share our work with integrity and balance the kind of whole ideas of creativity and artistic integrity with the realities of kind of marketing and business, which you will have to kind of face up to if you're going to be doing this for money. If you're going to make your living out of this, then you have to face up to those realities, you know. But how do you do that with integrity without losing your soul? It started with a whole load of blog posts, but it turned into an ebook that I published last year, a book which I basically wrote in 24 hours, because I just took a load of stuff that I'd written and rewrote it and edited it and repurposed it and put it together, and I gave it away free on my blog. And you can still get that. It's called Dance of the Writer, and it's a beginner's guide to authentic writing. So I did that, and you know, things started to happen. My blog started to grow. I started to get loads more subscribers than I'd ever had before, and like at a much quicker rate. Not kind of one of these crazy rates where I got 1,000 in like a day or something, but it's been steady growth ever since. And I mean, that wasn't my intention. That was just, I just wrote something that was really kind of going on inside of me and put it out there, and it kind of resonated with people. And so that happened. And this year, I kind of decided, well, what I should do is I should get these blog posts that I wrote over this time, or some of them, the ones on creativity, and kind of edit them a little and put them together as a kind of, because actually when I looked at them, there's kind of an arc there, like a story arc. Okay. It's like a character arc. It's like a, you know, and so what happens, I put those together in a book. I wrote kind of an introduction and a postscript and all that kind of thing, put some resources in there. And I put that out, and it's called Unlocking Creativity, Daily Words Which Help Me Find My Voice. And and I wrote the introduction, actually I wrote it as a prologue and an epilogue, because it's actually I found that it's actually a story, really, when you look at it. It's not kind of a normal book where you have kind of sequential chapters on different topics. It's just like, it's like, I don't know if anyone who's read this, The War of Art. It's basically The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. By the way, if you're anywhere interested in creativity, read that book. Seriously, I read it every year.
It is really a classic.
Yeah, it's like that. It's kind of got different posts on different topics. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a collection of blog posts, but a bit more than that. So that's what that book is. And and you can buy that. You can buy that on Amazon. But actually, what I'd love people to do is get this free. And there's a way you can get it free. which is by basically subscribing to my blog. And if you do that, you'll get the Dance of the Writer book I talked about free sent to your inbox. But you'll also get a link to a Facebook community, which is all about all the things that I talk about. We talk about creativity, we talk about identity and spirituality, all these kind of things. And people share their own work and we have kind of discussions and that kind of thing. And yeah, you get access to that group. And there you'll find a free download of this new book, the one that I've just talked about, Unlocking Creativity. So that's what I'd love people to do, because I don't mind if people pay me for it, you know. I really love people to I want people to read it, you know. I mean, I will publish books in the future which I'll charge money for, you know, and I will have work in the future which I charge money for, because, you know, work costs something. You know, and this is Rob Bell taught me that, actually. He said, and this is a guy, probably the guy with the most artistic integrity that I've ever met. He said, you know, it's okay to make money from your work, and work costs something. You know, it costs you time and energy and sometimes money to create it. And so it's not wrong to charge people for your work. The other thing that this kind of whole period led me into was coaching, because all these ideas that I came up with from this kind of period where I wasn't publishing anything, it gave me kind of ideas about how to coach people in identity and creativity and this kind of thing. And so I had a friend who wanted me to coach them, so I decided to try it out. And I told them that I wouldn't charge for it, because I was still kind of a new coach and I wanted to learn. And they told me afterwards they would have paid me for it, you know, if I'd asked them, you know. And actually, somebody has said that they won't let me coach them because they didn't want to charge them for it, because for various reasons. But they wanted to pay me. There is kind of an element of people. Sometimes people want to pay you for your work as well, and that's a really difficult thing for me, because I'm somebody that's really passionate about artistic integrity and authenticity and not making money your number one priority. I think if you make money your number one priority, and numbers and stats and impact, you know, if that's your kind of biggest goal, then you're not going to create the best work that you can. You're not going to create the most honest work that you can, and you're going to lose something. You're going to kind of lose your soul a little bit. That kind of work still might sell a lot of copies and make you loads of money, but is it really worth making loads of money if you're going to lose your soul? You know, so I'd rather create work which helps people. And if I make money from it, that's great. If I can make my living from it, that's great. But if I don't, that was never the point in the first place. So,
yeah, and I think that comes across. I think that's why when you start doing art in the sense of I'm going to do this actually, whether I make money at it or not, it does come across, and then people are attracted to it. But there are other models. I know some people who use the gifting economy model, where they say, you know, this is free, and if you want to pay what it's worth to you, you can, or you just take it. And then they find sometimes that people pay them more than they would have asked anyway. And so it's an interesting, you know, when we think about economics, you know, I'm sure it's similar in the UK, but there is a God that is worshipped in the United States, and it's money. And we are monotheists. We worship what? Money. And so usually things kind of tie into that, and it's sort of like people will decide on their careers or what they're going to do. What would you do that you wouldn't get paid? But of course you're going to want to get paid. I think that what does happen is we can get it backwards. And I think, you know, as you were working with selling services and trying to get numbers and things like that, and sort of losing your soul, getting disconnected from the authentic you, as you returned, then so did a following, because that was real. You know, it was
exactly.
Genuine.
Yeah. Exactly. I ended up being my blog sabbatical for about 3 months. And actually, by the time I came back, I didn't want to come back. I didn't want to publish anything. I was just quite content in a comfort zone, doing this stuff every day, just writing whatever I wanted and nobody seeing it. I was actually kind of enjoying that more. And it took a guest post for somebody else for me to actually get back out there again. And, you know, it was actually quite scary when I did. So, yeah, that's the kind of the other side of it. It's kind of amazing because when I started, I never would have felt like that. I never would have thought I would have felt like that. But that's what it ended up like, you know. And actually, this summer I did it again. I took, and it was more intentional this time. I got a bit dry, and I was kind of lacking ideas and kind of a bit burnt out and blogging out of duty. And it wasn't that the work wasn't authentic. It was, but it was just I was running out of. I'd lost the joy, kind of thing, and I'd lost my motivation, and also I had some ideas of things that I wanted to do, but I needed to go away and explore those. So I took some time off over this summer as well, and again that was really, really helpful. That helped me kind of get my podcast together and work on that, and without having to worry about putting anything out there, you know. So mm-hmm. I kind of think this is a good thing to do on a regular basis for creative people, because. Mm-hmm. And I know that Rob Bell does actually. Often after books come out, he just goes away and turns his phone off and doesn't do any creative work at all. And he just spends time with his family and that kind of thing. And when he's lucky, he can afford to do that, take a month off without working. But and I'm not jealous of that at all. But it's I think it's a good thing to do, to take some time away, and because it refreshes you when you come back and you have more energy. I'm a big believer in the principle of Sabbath. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say you should write 7 days a week. I don't believe that. I think it's really, I write 6 days a week. So I have 6 days where I'm working and creating and that kind of thing. And then I have a day where I don't do it deliberately, because I don't want it to become my idol. I don't want it to become my God. I don't want it to become the thing I organize my life around, you know. Because it's really important to me, it's not my God, you know, it's not my idol, it's not what I worship, it's not where my identity is grounded. Our identity has to be grounded in grace, in the fact that we're enough as we are, not, you know, not in what we do. I'm really, really, really passionate about that. I think it's too many people ground their identity and their security in what they do, or in how much money they make, or in their relationships, or in other things, and society kind of condones this in a lot of ways. You know, even church condones this. Like, people put their security identity in church, you know, in church, the institution of church, or their own church or religion, you know, or even the Bible, you know, like the Bible. I mean, that sounds really bad, doesn't it? But what I mean is, our identity security can't be in any of those things. It has to be in God himself. You know, God is bigger than the church, and bigger than the Bible, and bigger than, you know, any kind of religion. And you know, I worship Jesus, so I worship God, you know. That's, I have a relationship with him, and church allows me to express that, and my faith allows me to express that, and I express that through my creativity, but those are not my, and the Bible helps me understand that as well, but those are not my idols, you know. God isn't an idol, but well, we can make God into an idol, but I'm a follower of Jesus, you know, and that's, so my security comes from him, and him saying that I'm enough, and that I belong, and that I'm lovable, and that I'm accepted as I am, you know, for who I am.
Yeah, the idea of sabbatical, I've noticed, is really helpful too, because what happens is we get into this false dichotomy of our head and our body. Like, I know a lot of writers, and for me too, if I'm working on something and I'm writing a book right now that should go out this month on discernment. And as I'm writing it, I'm pouring into it, and I might forget that I'm sitting on my foot in a strange way, and it falls asleep. And I'm realizing how disconnected I am from, like, physical sensations in my body. And it's that sabbatical in the day and in the week that gets you back out of your head and fully integrated into your body, so that you're whole, you know. And I have noticed that when you push yourself too hard, you become really segmented and kind of lose your way that in that regard.
Yeah, that's true. That's definitely true. I totally agree. Yeah.
And so what do you think in the book that you've created on creativity and authenticity is the nugget people need to hear the most?
In that book, I think there's one part of it where I talk about success and failure, where I think we get to define our own success. I think, and this is something that I talk about when I do coaching, we have kind of consumerism, and there's a lot of writers and bloggers and thought leaders and all these kind of people who kind of define what success is. And success is when you get a book contract. Success is when you sold X number of books. Success is when you're on the New York Times bestseller list. Success is when you've got X number of subscribers, whatever kind of thing. And that's just a horrendous lie. And I think it's really important that we define what success looks like for us rather than allow other people to. Mm. And that we have big dreams, but small expectations. Like, so what I say to people when I'm coaching them is I say, okay, what's your big dream? And then we talk about that and that kind of thing. And that's great. And it's really important to have big dreams. But the only way to get there is to have small expectations. So you say you want to get a book published, or you want to get a book published, but that's your big dream. Or you want to speak at this conference, or you want to meet this person, or whatever. But you have small expectations along the way to get there. So what's the first thing you can do? So what's the first, start up a blog. Okay. So my expectation for this month is I'll post a blog post every week. And that's great. So you do that, and then like you achieve that, and then that is success. You've done that and you're a success. So suddenly you've got more confidence to go for the next step and set yourself slightly bigger expectations. And then you go along and you achieve all of these, and eventually you get towards that big dream. And so, you know, for me, for example, like the day that my first print book goes live on Amazon next year, the book will be a success because it exists because I've got a book that's a print book that's on Amazon. That's it. That moment is a success. Even if it sells zero copies, and I hope it doesn't, but if it sells zero copies, it's still a success because I made it and I put it out there and because I did it. You know, like that book, the creativity book that I'm talking about that's on Amazon, that's a success because I put it on Amazon and because I put a book on Amazon for the first time in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, so I did it. I achieved it. You know. And that's really, really important that we grasp this idea that kind of, and you know, that we're not, that success is not all of those things that everyone talks about. It is like, and the biggest lie actually that is out there that really kind of irks me when I see people talk about it is like, do you want to have an impact? Do you want your life to have an impact? Do you want your work to be seen by nobody, or do you want to leave a big impact on people's lives? And this is kind of, it sounds very appealing on the surface. It's like, oh, I want to have an impact. I want to make a difference. I want to leave a legacy, you know. And playing on people's fear of being forgotten, playing on people's fear of being insignificant, and that once they're gone, they won't be remembered. And that your life, and what the message that it sends out is that your life only matters if you have a huge impact on people. Your work only matters if it has a huge impact on people, and your work and your life and your work only matter if you impact a lot of people. And that's just a horrendous lie. First, we all have an impact. Every single person has an impact. You know, most people don't get are not forgotten when they die. You know, there are people that you love, people who love you, who will have been impacted by you living out your life, by your relationships with them. So you will not be forgotten, and you will have had an impact. You know, it's actually living the thing that has the most impact is not what you do; it's living the right kind of life and being the right kind of person. You know. I mean, how many stories have you heard about people who, like, nobody knew who they were, like they weren't famous, they weren't well known. But when they had their funeral, like the churches were packed, like all these people from all over the place, people who the family didn't even know about, and it was just little things that this person did for these people mm-hmm. that had a huge impact. Little words of encouragement, little actions, little acts of service. You know, just about being who they were, not trying to be somebody, not trying to like be well known and impact in inverted commas. hundreds of thousands of people or whatever. But they had a huge impact just by being who they were and just by trying to live the right kind of life. And so it kind of gets me kind of worked up when I see people like writers, respected writers on Twitter saying, talking about you, kind of alluding to this idea that you only have an impact if you, and your work only has an impact, or your work only matters and you only matter if it impacts lots, if it has a lot of, if you get a lot of readers, subscribers, followers, you know, it's like, do you want to broaden your impact? Do you want to, do you want to die unfulfilled or like, but that's not what life's about. You know, I mean, those things are, it's nice, those things are nice and they're good and they're honorable aspirations, you know, to want to have your work impact a lot of people, to want to have your life impact a lot of people, that they're honorable goals. But sometimes I think that people, some writers use that as a kind of tool to manipulate people, and that it actually ends up with people feeling like they're worth nothing if they don't achieve the crazy levels that only a few people actually ever achieve, you know, because, you know, like for most of us in about in 100, 200 years time, most of us won't be remembered by that many people unless we end up being someone like Gandhi or, you know, or.
Well, I think it's even worse, you know, than I mean, that, because if I ask someone who's 15 or 20 years old, what do they know about, you know, a president of the United States from 20 years ago? They might know kind of what he did. So like even someone world famous in just one generation is forgotten. And the proof is, like, how much do you know about any of your great grandparents?
Exactly. This is
like,
that, that's,
you know,
exactly,
pretty
yes.
much, maybe, you know, two or three things about them and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I know a few things about my great parents, but what they did, but that's it.
Yeah.
You know, and ultimately it doesn't matter, you know, like, I mean, yeah, I mean, a lot of people are so afraid of, and I'm going to talk about this on a podcast, I think. Mm-hmm. I think I want to talk about kind of legacy and actually talk about death and that kind of thing, all that, because I think these things are really, really important and they're not often talked about. Mm-hmm. But what's important is becoming the person, becoming the right kind of person now, the kind of person that you are inside, because that will impact everything that you do. It'll impact all your writing, all your creative work, all your whatever job you do. It will impact that. It will impact your relationships. And that is much more important than selling lots of books, you know. And you, and this, it goes back to this thing I talk about all the time. People matter not because of what they do, but because they exist. Mm. And people's work matters not because of how many people it impacts, but because it exists. Mm. And people, and I saw a blog post by somebody that basically said that art for its own sake is basically a hobby, and that it's in, that it doesn't, that it's worthless. And you know, I'm not going to say who it is, but it was, I felt that was so insulting to so many creative people. People who actually do this for a living as well, or people who do this professionally and want to make a living out of it, but also do it because they love it and actually don't care whether it gets lots of followers or not. You know, because I do, I felt it insulted me, because I do what I do because I love doing it. I love writing, I love creating things, I love sharing with people, I love being able to do that, you know, and I would do it whether I make money from it or not, you know. So, but it's not a hobby for me either. It's not
a
hobby.
It's a passion. Yeah. It's your heart's cry, and it's a passion.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think people really need to get writers, creative people out there, just do what you love to do. Talk about what you're passionate about, what you care about, and put it out there. And then whatever the outcome, and yeah, good, market it, promote it. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with doing that. But don't rest your identity, your security, your value on the outcome. Just create the work, put it out there, do the best work you possibly can and put it out there, and just surrender the outcome.
Did you know that every episode of Spark My Muse has show notes? You can find show notes at sparkmymuse.com. And in those show notes, you'll find details about the people, books, and resources that were mentioned in the show. And sometimes you'll find photos and embedded videos, too. I hope you'll stop by and check it out.